Yes, hello, it's Jason Louv. Welcome back to the Ultra Culture podcast. My episode today is about role-playing games. Do role-playing games actually lead to the occult? Spoiler, yes. And can they actually be of value, not just to people who are interested in magic, but to adults, period? We're going to talk about the top five benefits of role-playing games for occult-oriented people, and I'm going to talk about the top five occult role-playing games of all time. This is a super fun one for obvious reasons. I got to talk about gaming instead of like current events or the news. So I really enjoyed making this episode, and I think you're definitely going to enjoy it too. Okay, so this episode is a bit of a double up. This was released as a YouTube also, and so this is the audio. And so if I refer to video or things that are on camera, obviously, you won't be able to see them, but that's not going to change your enjoyment of this experience. So as I mentioned on the show before, I'm putting a lot more effort into doing YouTube, original content for YouTube, just because basically that's just the way our society is going. But also because obviously since there's video, there's way almost infinitely more creative potential than podcasts, and podcasts already have practically unlimited creative potential. So this is an incredibly exciting time to be alive. Anyone can do this. What a time to be alive. Of course, producing a 2-hour podcast and a 45-minute YouTube every week is in addition to running the business and producing more courses for you at magic.me is a phenomenal amount of work. So as I kind of ease into that, we're probably going to double up. The podcast will continue as usual. It's not changing. It's not going anywhere. I'm still going to be interviewing people. It's still going to be the best, most comprehensive occult podcast on the internet. And in addition, it will often include solo podcasts that are me imparting information. But since that's part of why you're here, I think that that will only add to this experience rather than certainly detract from it. And make sure you're subscribed to the YouTube, since that's where all the video episodes are going to be. It's at Magic Me School, or just search Magic Me on YouTube. I hope you're already subscribed to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to it. Definitely also go make sure that you're subscribed to the YouTube. Like and subscribe, hit the notifications bell, because we are trying to release every Friday. So you'll get notifications when new episodes come out. We're hoping for a new podcast Monday, new YouTubes Friday. Head over to YouTube, get involved in our community, get involved in the comments. The comments section is, they're opening a portal to something. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing in the comments section, but a portal is opening. And if you want to find out what comes through, head over to YouTube. It's at Magic Me School, or just search Magic Me on YouTube. Tons of new content. So we got lots coming for you. All right. So without further ado, here's the episode. In the 1980s, Christian fundamentalists lost their freaking mind, thinking that role-playing games were turning people to the occult. Were they right? We're going to cover all that as we break down the top five occult role-playing games of all time. And yes, how they overlap with actual real-life magic. I'm a huge fan of tabletop role-playing games. I love them. They are one of my great passions in life, and they always have been, except for the very brief period of my life, for about 20 years, when I decided I was too grown up and mature for role-playing games. What a mistake. Follow your passions. Find what you love. Role-playing games are absolutely one of the things I love, and they are absolutely not only do they have a lot of overlap with the real occult in a good and positive way, but they are phenomenal for developing your imagination and visualization skills, along with a whole lot of other deeper, esoteric, metaphysical, and unbelievably profound things that role-playing can do. I am convinced in many ways that role-playing is the most advanced medium that human beings have. What it actually is a callback to the days of storytelling when people sat around a fire telling stories. Okay. So what am I talking about? What are tabletop role-playing games? They're not the computer kind or the PlayStation kind, although I love the new Baldur's Gate. It's amazing. They're the type of games that you play with your friends around a table where you have books, dice, pencils, character sheets, all of that. The most famous example of this is, of course, Dungeons and Dragons, which you probably heard of. Almost everyone has heard of it at this point. There was even a movie recently, and it's become massively, massively popular. It always was, but now it's on a level that it never has been before, due to YouTube, I think, and shows like Critical Role. In Dungeons and Dragons, pretty much like every tabletop role-playing game, you have one person who takes on the role of the game master. And they're the one that completely invents the world. They invent in a completely imaginary world, or get one out of a book, but inventing is more fun. World building, as if they're creating a fantasy world for, or science fiction world or horror world for a novel. And then they gather together anywhere from 2 to 6, sometimes many, many more people to inhabit characters in that story. In the case of Dungeons and Dragons, the story is almost always about a group of adventurers, like a wizard, a cleric, a druid, a barbarian, a paladin, all the classic fantasy tropes, out on an adventure, killing monsters, getting treasure, going up levels, getting experience points. It is the Stranger Things experience. And yes, Stranger Things definitely was filmed about people my age. That was me at that time. There's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of role-playing games. And although Dungeons and Dragons may be the most famous one, role-playing games get really esoteric. There are pretty much bizarre games for almost certainly every media franchise you can imagine, but also all kinds of interesting settings. So what are we really talking about here? This is not a role-playing channel. What are we really talking about here? Real simple. Group astral projection. Okay? What is astral projection? Essentially, it is developing your imagination to the point where you can imagine yourself going somewhere else and having experiences, getting information, learning, doing magical things, that type of thing. It essentially is willed imagination, creative visualization. Okay? So, with that said, you can kind of see how 6 people or so sitting around a table, imagining that they're wizards, clerics, and barbarians, while one person imagines the astral world for them to project to, is essentially group astral projection. One of the most common complaints that students of magic have is something along the lines of, I can't visualize. Now, there are conditions that make it literally so you can't visualize, but by and large, my response to this is always, how much practice have you had? Role-playing games are a phenomenal, phenomenal way to get that practice. And if evangelical Christians had known this in the 80s, they would have thrown an even bigger fit than they actually did. For those of us who might these days be recognized as neurodivergent or on the autistic spectrum or anything like that, these were often the only way to make friends and also an incredible way to practice social skills. A lot of the things that we take for granted now in pop culture were not quite as socially acceptable as they are now. These days, everyone goes to see Marvel movies. They're the biggest grossing movies of the cinema. But back then, reading comic books, even in the 80s, could still get you beat up and exiled and from polite company and all that type of stuff. It still marked you as a loser. And Dungeons and Dragons was seen as even worse. It was seen as the ultimate loser activity. Like if you played it, you were basically off the genetic potential list for all time. You were never going to get laid. You were just destined to be a basement dwelling nerd for all eternity. Now, all of us smart nerds who actually played Dungeons and Dragons while our peers were focusing on sports and all of that stuff, which is a fleeting glory that lasts only for high school. We all grew up and essentially created the tech industry, the internet, and a lot of the cool stuff in society. But back then, Dungeons and Dragons was the worst thing you could be into. And it wasn't just because it marked you as a loser, it marked you as potentially a Satanist. That's because of this book, The Monster Manual, which is just a collection of monsters to throw at your players in Dungeons and Dragons. It's full of elves and dragons and all the stuff we recognize from fantasy literature and movies and books and all that stuff. Now, the people who created this game decided to include demons and devils, which is a normal thing to include if you're trying to make a book of monsters for people to fight. So these are just stats for demons. But in particular, you may be able to see an extremely bad, yet somehow strangely alluring picture of a naked succubus that looks like it was done by a very bad prison tattooist. Actually, I might Now that I mention it, this actually would be a pretty awesome tattoo. I might do that. This image is important because this image specifically sent America into a tailspin of insanity. You can kind of imagine being a Christian parent in the early 80s. This is, remember, way before the internet. You know, Reagan was president, but we were all into Red Dawn and Rambo and all of that stuff. But heavy metal was getting popular. You know, to be fair, you can kind of imagine being a parent, a Christian parent, or really any parent, and coming in. And remember, this is before the internet. This is before you could look things up. There were only a few channels. I don't think even video rental places were big yet. But you can kind of imagine going into your kid's room and finding a book that you open up that has kind of what looks like occult diagrams to summon demons. Now, in my case, I actually had those books as a teenager, but that's because Dungeons and Dragons actually does lead to the occult. But that was just me. The majority of people who played Dungeons and Dragons, and there's a lot of them now, a lot, a recent statistics came out that I think over 37% of Americans have played a tabletop role-playing game at some point in their life, and 5% play at least once a week or more. That's incredible. Back then, it was a bunch of acne nerds with pocket protectors, you know, people who would be the last people to get invited to like a cool kids party where people actually did fun stuff, the least likely to do drugs, least likely to get laid, most likely to excel in schoolwork and have a creative imagination. In short, Dungeons and Dragons should be every parent's dream, because essentially what your kids are doing when they're playing it is simulating a corporate board meeting with notes instead of going out and, I don't know, getting drunk and crashing into a pole. It also involves kids staying home under parental watch. So why parents ever freaked out about Dungeons and Dragons, really, it's an incredible thing to encourage kids to do. But you can imagine seeing demons and kind of blowing your top. Worries that adults had about role-playing games kind of all blurred together in their mind with heavy metal and anything else bad or satanic that they could possibly spot. And what happened is a lot of people really had a hard time of it. I mean, like Anton LaVey, who at that time, Zena LaVey, his daughter was very young. Zena LaVey has talked about having to spray paint the windows black of their house in San Francisco and crawl under the windowsills because people would shoot at them through the window if they saw them. I mean, this is how crazy evangelical Christians can be, and they haven't changed. There's lots of other high profile cases of people like Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, basically anybody who was out in the public saying that they were an occultist or a Satanist was just targeted. So Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino, the head of the Temple of Set, was accused of like molesting kids in his basement and running a huge human trafficking ring and all of this stuff. None of this was true. My mentor, Genesis Purich, was also accused of that by an evangelical Christian. None of that was true. And these had real consequences. There were destroyed lives over this. And at the very least, the gnosis that was really starting to come out of that time got stamped down for a little while. A lot of this, of course, is superstition. And, you know, if you take anything away from this, be grateful that we have the internet, because nobody could go find better information. And so they did what Americans have been doing since the beginning of the founding of this country, which is they went into a good old fashioned witch hunt. This, by the way, is a prime example, as an example number one, of where conspiracy thinking and QAnon-type insanity can lead. And if you think things have changed, even though we have the internet, if you think things have changed, they really haven't. These people are still as crazy as they ever were, and now they're using the internet to coordinate and spread their QAnon insanity. Luckily, this blew over by the 90s. It was still going in the early 1990s. I remember that in elementary school. I remember police coming into the class and giving us handbooks of how to avoid satanic cults that mentioned Dungeons and Dragons, saying that satanic cults in robes would pull up and abduct us and take us to be sacrificed in the woods. I mean, these are adult authority figures telling you this. And when adult authority figures tell you something when you're in fifth grade, it's pretty serious. But it did blow over. And now in 2024, everyone plays these games from all walks of life. There's no longer as much of a stigma around it. You even see Dungeons and Dragons books in Target. It's kind of everywhere these days, because I think people have realized there's a lot of stuff in there that's actually the vitamins they may need most. And back then, it was just us pocket protector nerds. But now the virus has spread and role-playing games have gone out to the entire world, and people from all walks of life, ages, genders, background, professions, classes, sexual orientations, that play these games and get tremendous benefits from them that I never would have imagined. For instance, it turns out to be really, really good for transitioning away from sex work. Who would have thunk? But it turns out to be amazing for that, for sex workers who've decided to leave that industry. One of the reasons we need to be ever vigilant about this is the satanic panic is really just one iteration of something that superstitious hordes of easily worked up people have been doing since the beginning of time. This is one of the real evils in our world. Not demons in a role-playing game book for kids to exercise their imagination, but real evil, religious fundamentalism, superstition, the willingness to persecute and kill people for your beliefs, or at least ruin their lives, and most of all, the ability to just see anything and interpret it as somehow satanic. I mean, I've watched videos online of evangelical Christians saying Monster energy drink is satanic because somehow the M equals 666 in Kabbalah. So, you know, for a certain type of person, they can find anything satanic and they don't need an excuse. And then what follows is not pretty. This is something that all of us need to be particularly aware of as religious fundamentalism is coming back. But that's a topic for another video that I will do. Now that everyone loves role-playing games, they're out there. They're easy to get. It's very easy to find people to play with you. Just go to your local game store. They usually have a bulletin board. People can play online now on sites like roll20.com, which is great. Nothing really beats in person with anything, but particularly role-playing games. But it's very easy to find people to play with now, even if you're totally new, you don't know the rules, etc. Now, what I'm going to do is go over the top five tremendously good benefits that it can have for your life, particularly if you're a magical person. And then I'm going to go down the list of the top five occult-influenced role-playing games of all time. Okay, number five. It is an incredible, therapeutic, cathartic, emotional release. Usually this comes in unexpected ways. But at the end of the day, role-playing games usually involve sitting around a table with some friends, possibly your closest friends, for maybe 4 or 5 hours or longer, and imagining and stepping out of your normal existence. It's so cathartic to pretend to be somebody else, at least for a short period of time. Everybody has had this experience, because this is why we go to the movies, why we read books, why we really consume any media, is to forget about our problems for a short while when we focus on other people who are imaginary. Role-playing games are far more profound because instead of watching somebody else's drama on a screen or reading it on a page, you get to be that person. You get to astrally project, step out of your life, and take on the role of somebody who may be totally different from you, maybe totally opposite to you. It's an incredible way to expand your understanding of human personality, by the way. But in doing that, and kind of stepping out of yourself, getting out of your own way, not only is this in itself profoundly cathartic, but the funniest stuff ever can happen in role-playing games, even if it's not, sometimes particularly, even if it's a serious game. The laughter that comes out of role-playing games, with people getting together, pretending to be other people, and trying to build a shared world together, unbelievable. Some of the funniest moments of my life have come out of role-playing games. And these days particularly, there's nothing quite as good for you as sitting around with your friends, telling stories and cracking up. And that's what role-playing games can do, among many, many other things. There's, you know, you can even look at like super goth, tragic role-playing games like Vampire the Masquerade or similar games from White Wolf and see them as a form of shadow work. In those games, you take on the role of being a vampire or a werewolf in a modern day context. And often they are totally focused on darkness and shadow. And so this can be a form of shadow work as well. Those are just two examples of the many, many profound opportunities for catharsis that role-playing games offer. Number four, we've already talked about quite a bit, and that is exercising your imagination and visualization skills. There is nothing like role-playing games for developing those faculties. And it's no surprise, by the way, that the kids who grew up playing these, whether it was the 70s, 80s, 90s, went on to become some of the biggest cultural creatives. I mean, you know, I lived in LA for 11 years. I can attest to this. tons of entertainment industry people, particularly screenwriters, but also a lot of actors, love role-playing games and grew up playing them. And because their imaginations are developed to this point, they have excelled in their creative careers. And these days, you've got a lot of creative celebrities playing as well, like Vin Diesel, Vince Vaughn, actually, Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine. It's kind of amazing how much it's spread, particularly in creative professions. It's also not a surprise at all that the kids who grew up playing these and then went on into the tech industry incorporated a lot of the ideas into the tech that we use every day. So here's a rather pertinent example of that. Almost all role-playing games come with what's called a character sheet, which is where you put the stats for your character, the loot they get, their experience points, all of that, and has all of their traits and characteristics. This simple idea from role-playing is why we have social media profiles now. Just the idea of having a Facebook page or a MySpace page, those are basically character sheets for people. And, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Tom from MySpace, people like this, they were totally aware of this. This idea, the social profile, comes from role-playing games. In a way, our entire world has become a role-playing game online. I mean, even LinkedIn, you have your career character sheet on LinkedIn. Hopefully this is without the social credit score, but I digress. I just offer this as an example, just a few examples of how role-playing games, or rather the people that grew up playing them, have saturated our world with ideas from them and how positive that is. Maybe not social media, but certainly all the creative stuff. Number three for occult interested people or spirituality interested people in specific, as I've mentioned, it's essentially group astral projection. So these days, everyone's into psychedelics. Freaking everyone's into psychedelics. Podcasters are into psychedelics. Tech pros are into psychedelics. They're seen as just another commodity, a way to get an idea for your next app or something like that. We in nerd culture have different psychedelic drugs. We have role-playing games. While all the burnout kids were drinking Miller Lite and listening to Bruce Springsteen and their Dodge Charger or whatever, we were tripping without drugs in a creative way that improved our skills. Role-playing games are a form of tripping, a sober way of tripping. I would say they're cheaper than drugs, but if you get really into this stuff, as I will show you, you can buy a lot of books. But I'm just obsessive. You don't need to do that. You really don't need anything to get into role-playing. You just need to go to your game store and meet people. Number two, they are a temporary autonomous zone. Again, if you're an occult person, I'm sure you know this term. But even for non-occult people, let me put it this way. They're a safe space for you to be you. These days, everything is public. There's no privacy anymore. If you say something online, or if you do basically anything these days whatsoever, it can and will be used against you if it's shown to the world. Not everything has to be shown to the internet. I know that may come as a shock, but your entire life does not need to be broadcast to the internet. We have all been given the burden of self-censorship in almost everything we do or say now. It's unbelievably insidious. And people are simply just afraid to speak their mind, thinking that it may be misinterpreted, that they may be canceled. And so we've kind of sleepwalked into a world where everyone is walking on eggshells, afraid of what somebody might think, afraid of what somebody may comment on social media, afraid of being canceled, this type of thing. That kind of ambient stress, and it is ambient, it's just you can't get away from it, it seems, is not good for people. It's probably physically not good for people. So we need a pressure release. There need to be spaces where you can just let your hair down. I can't do that, but if you have hair, you can. There need to be spaces where it's okay, you're free to speak your mind, where you can be you, even be somebody else, but you're not watching what you're saying. You're not afraid to, go wild, because unless you're recording it, but as long as you're not recording it and you trust your friends, it can be a safe space for exploration of ideas, of concepts, a place to blow off steam. In short, they are little bubbles in which you can get away from some of the worst parts of our culture right now. Okay, number one, first and foremost, they're the cure for cell phones. I'm 100% serious. Our world has a cell phone problem. When Steve Jobs released the iPhone in 2008, it seemed like the coolest thing ever. Now it's completely destroyed the fabric of civilization. Everyone walks around with their nose down in their freaking phone. Everything's on social media. Everyone is carrying around this source of unbelievable stress, distraction, this device that just pulls them out of their experience, their real life, and then wastes it on for hours on end in scrolling various BS websites. What is the true message of the cell phone? It's interesting. Cell phones are a bit of a paradox because they're sold as a way to stay connected with the entire world. But in actual practice, they deeply isolate us from the rest of the world. They allow us to live in our own reality, our own bubble. That's not good. They allow you to walk down the street with your headphones in, ignoring the world. Hopefully you don't get mugged. And you know, checking the news and basically living in your own designer reality and having very little overlap with the rest of the world. And so it's no wonder that these things are just driving people insane, particularly TikTok. One of the things that people used to criticize role-playing games for is that they were disassociative, that you were disassociating from your problems, playing pretend. I think that cell phones are what actually do that. Role-playing games, if anything, allow you to be ultra-associated and focused on a group activity that involves connection with other people. Cell phones disconnect you from the world. I hate them. I have one because you kind of have to these days. It's like mandatory, it seems. But I deeply dislike cell phones. I mean, you don't need me to say, it's not just the cell phones. The level of isolation and alienation in our society right now is just at epidemic levels. There was a great book about it, written about that, called Bowling Alone, which is about the death of group activities like fraternal organizations or Elks Lodge or bowling or things like that. The death of public activities that you go out and do with other people and just the collapse of people into their inner world, in this world of just endless digital entertainment and streaming that's offered to us, and that this is a huge sociological problem. Of course, we had the quite traumatic for quite a few people COVID era, in which we had to isolate, we had to social distance, in which people were disconnected very, very deeply and profoundly, forcefully, combined with the already deeply isolated, alienated, frankly insane state of most of America. This sent people into a tailspin, another of a different type, but another tailspin of insanity that we have yet to come out of, I think, and that we have yet to see the full effects of. A lot of us were very, very isolated during COVID, and nothing is more healing and helpful for those feelings of isolation and disconnecting as getting around a table with a bunch of your friends. And by the way, you're not drinking. Unless you combine, I recommend not combining that, but it's like you're not going out to a bar. You're not, you know, trying to put up a front to impress people. You know, you're not networking. It's not serious, things like that. And frankly, a lot of the kind of social hierarchy games, the status games that people play out in public that can, you know, are sometimes very hard to understand, particularly if you're neurodivergent. None of that. I mean, it's like role-playing games. They kind of cut that out. I mean, think about it. If you're pretending to be a fantasy character, you may be competing with people in the game, but it's very hard to do the kind of like, oh, well, like I'm so-and-so and I have this job and I've met these famous people and all. Like, it's very, very hard to do that. And so it kind of takes out all the BS stuff out of social situations that just kind of seem like wasting oxygen to me. Other people love them, but there you go. Oh yeah, the other thing is you actually have to have a personality and be agreeable to play role-playing games. You can't fake it like most people do out in public by getting drunk or doing a couple lines of blow or whatever, or just being their own aggressively stupid personas. Oh, finally, there's a zero. So 5 plus 0. Zero is they show, and this is the most profound of all, they show you that life is a role-playing game. It's kind of like an extra-dimensional yoga. They show you that everyone out there in the world is playing a role-playing game. They just have forgotten that they are playing it. And if that's not a profound metaphor for spirituality and magic, I don't know what is. Not to mention that once you realize that in role-playing, once you realize that through role-playing games, you can do in life just the same thing that you're doing in role-playing games, which is essentially playing games, stopping, going on, taking a different persona, going on a different quest, seeing your life as progression, actually really useful. I've learned some of the best things about like life, even running a business, I've learned from role-playing games and from seeing my life as a role-playing game. And there's tons more. And frankly, role-playing games are different for every person or every group that plays them. Every game is different. The benefits are immense. So look, I think people still have the stigma, this hang up that role-playing games are for kids, for teenagers, that there's something that you should grow out of. Look, I'm a 42-year-old man, okay? And yes, I may be the sorcerer supreme of this reality, yada, yada, yada. But you know what? F it. What I really want to be doing with my time is playing role-playing games with my best friends. And I'm going to talk about it on this channel from time to time. So I hope that you've gotten at least a little bit of my passion for this. With that said, here's what you came here for. The top five occult or occult-influenced role-playing games of all time. So let's start with number five. And we've already talked about it a lot, but it has to be mentioned. Dungeons and Dragons. Okay, so check this out. Statistica.com, which is similar to the Pew Research Center, they do surveys and demographics and that type of thing. In the study they did on role-playing games in 2022, found that 1 in 10 Americans, it's more than 1 in 10 have played role-playing games, it's like 1 in 6, but 1 in 10 Americans actively play role-playing games. And I guarantee like 99% of those people are playing Dungeons and Dragons. Dungeons and Dragons is the world's most popular role-playing game. It probably always will be. There's a movies have come out recently. Stranger Things really, you know, made it blow up yet again. And it's just everywhere. You can see the books everywhere. You can get the books at Target. It's very, very, very mainstream now. Okay, now why do I mention it on the occult role-playing games list? A lot of the people that played these games, and Dungeons and Dragons in particular, later went on to become interested in forms of spirituality that are kind of like role-playing games. I mean, if you look at a lot of certainly Western occult books, you will get a lot of stuff that looks like role-playing game art. And Dungeons and Dragons is a game in which you can be a wizard. You can get magical powers. You can learn spells and all of this stuff. And that archetype often deeply, deeply, deeply appeals to people enough that they become, like myself, go look for things that are similar in the real world. Is this a good idea? Probably not, but it's how I ended up here, so here we are. I mean, we already looked at the Hot Succubus, but I mean, this is the Player's Handbook from 1977 or 79, something like that. And tell me that this doesn't look like a diagram from an occult book. I'm sure this is another thing that set parents off, but I mean, like, this is a map of the planes of existence that you can astrally travel to. So while, you know, parents were accusing role-playing games of being satanic, a lot of the people who played them later went on to become interested in magic. I don't consider magic satanic, by the way. It's almost always very, very positive. But it absolutely had an effect on people. And I think one of the reasons it had such an effect is because of the satanic panic, because you know how people are. They always want to find out about the thing that they're told is bad or that they can't do. Always, invariably. It's human nature. And you can kind of imagine that if crazy Christian cultists who believe in Sky Daddy or whatever it is that they think is real, their role-playing game, try to take something away from you that you really, really, really love and allows you to connect with your friends, you might dig your heels in a little. In fact, you might dig your heels in a lot. And that's pretty much what happened. And one of those things is that, you know, this is also human nature. If you get accused of being a Satanist and an occultist and a witch enough, eventually you will actually start identifying with that, or at least in a sarcastic way. You may actually go look at some of those books. So by the time the satanic panic actually died down, a lot of role players actually were interested in the occult. And by the late 90s, I mean, White Wolf released this, Demon the Fallen, basically as a joke about the satanic panic. And this is a game where you actually can be a demon. And they essentially made this as the game that Christians thought people were playing. Number four, Ars Magica. This is not a very well-known game, but it's an incredibly important and influential one. So this, again, I think this came out the late 80s. So just kind of like the tail end of this, or actually the peak of the satanic panic. Anyways, late 80s, early 90s. And this is a game that tried to do realistic medieval magic. So it's similar to Dungeons and Dragons, but there are fantastic elements, but it's a much more realistic look at kind of medieval magic. You can be a hermeticist in here, like, you know, there's a lot of hermetic magic and Kabbalah in here. This game never took off, but it's an incredibly important for a couple reasons. So just check out the description on the back. Ars Magica is state-of-the-art fantasy, set in a dark vision of the medieval world. It is a mythic setting where our superstitions are fact. In this game, you can play a magus with the full power of legendary wizards, or the companion of such a sorcerer, a talented ally with your own unique motivations and antipathies. As a magus, your life is devoted to the art of magic. Without it, you are not but a scholar and keeper of old books. So while this game never really took off, it's incredibly culturally important because it kind of represents a stepping off point from the 80s to the 90s. This is the transitional role-playing game. So this game was designed by Mark Reinhagen, who later went on to develop the most popular role-playing game of the 1990s, briefly more popular than Dungeons & Dragons, Vampire the Masquerade, the super edgy goth role-playing game that actually got girls into role-playing for the first time, made the role-playing industry now full of edgy goths who thought they were the Crow and often wore Crow makeup. I will neither confirm nor deny that I ever did that, but this later changed the world. That was the first edition of the game from 1991. This is the fifth edition. It's still going strong. It's from 2018. There's live plays of this all over YouTube, by the way. Look up LA by Night, New York by Night, and you can see professional actors playing this game. Same with Dungeons and Dragons. Just look up Critical Role. Actual play sessions have skyrocketed interest in this hobby because now you can just get on YouTube and watch people playing, professionals playing the game, so you understand how they go. But anyways, back to Mark Reinhagen's first game, Ars Magica. Now, I've had Mark Reinhagen on my podcast, and the episode is actually on this YouTube channel if you want to go look. And that was an amazing, that was super awesome to interview him. He's arguably the best role-playing game designer or creator since Gary Gygax. But one of the things he told me, whether you're interested in role-playing games or not, one of the things he told me that was very, very interesting is the people who wrote Twilight ripped off essentially his games, his later games, Vampire and Werewolf. They carbon copied it. The entire paranormal romance genre essentially came out of these games. And it was the massive popularity of Twilight that essentially got Christians to lighten up a little bit and just chill on thinking kids' books are satanic and all of this. So we have these games to thank for pushing back the Christian right on certain fronts. This is a big deal. So I chose Ars Magica, which was not a particularly big game, not just for the fact that it was an early attempt to depict actual real magic in a role-playing game, albeit the medieval form, but still real hermetic magic. But I also chose it because it does represent that hopping off point. And what that means is this book essentially came at the end of the Satanic Panic, and it was Mark Reinhagen's next game, Vampire, that started the next phase of role-playing, which was the Edgelord 90s. And what happened in the 90s is role-playing games started to overlap with alternative culture. Goths started to get into them. Punk kids started to get into them. They became a countercultural pursuit in their own right. And so games started coming out where instead of playing, you know, fantasy wizards and things like that, you could play an actual occultist, an actual vampire in the gritty modern world of darkness, as he called his fantasy setting. So this is the point when role-playing games really started cooking on incorporating real occult material. And that's why Ars Magica is important. And this leads us to our third game, the ultimate in 90s edgelording cult. So this was a game that came out in the early days of the Edgelord 90s. And this is literally just an occult role-playing game that is full of real magic and involves you hiding from and being persecuted by the Archons and the forces of the Cliffoth. I've never actually played this game. My brother bought this for me. I'm kind of afraid of this game. I'm just gonna push it over there. Just get that. Actually, I'm gonna flip it over. It's, I know you can't see it, but just stop thinking about it. Okay, don't look at it. Just don't think about it. It doesn't exist. Okay, moving on. All right, number two. The venerable, the great, the nonstop, often considered best role-playing game in history from a literary viewpoint. Can you guess what it is? It is, of course, Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game where you get to role-play doomed investigators in H.P. Lovecraft's world of Elder Things, Great Old Ones, Forbidden Sorceries, and so forth. This actually did not come out in the Edgelord 90s, although it definitely presaged them. This is kind of like what the Stooges were to punk. If White Wolf was punk rock, this is Iggy Pop and the Stooges, okay? Classic. Now, this game's a lot different from Dungeons & Dragons for a couple reasons. One is it's a horror game. I believe it might be the first one. I may be wrong about that, but it's a horror-themed role-playing game. Also, this game, Call of Cthulhu, is pretty much where the survival horror genre of video games comes from, and this is why. So in Dungeons & Dragons, it's all about progression. You're always getting experience points, you're getting more levels, you're getting more treasure, more weapons, more armor, more. It's Dungeons & Dragons is basically, you know, capitalism in its purest form in some ways. It's a capitalist game. Call of Cthulhu, however, goes in the complete opposite direction, which is instead of constantly progressing and getting more, your character has 100 sanity points. And every time they see something horrible happen, or God forbid, they see a Lovecraft monster, they lose massive amounts of sanity until they get to zero and they are a gibbering wreck who must be committed to an insane asylum. And there's no way to avoid it. Call of Cthulhu is a game just about staving off oblivion and madness. And that thematic element not only created survival horror, but makes for an amazingly fun game. And a game that can actually be quite terrifying, and actually quite an epic game. It's well considered in the role-playing industry that the published adventures for Call of Cthulhu, for instance, Masks of Nyarlathotep, are the best published adventures for any game in role-playing history. I haven't played them, so I can't vouch for them, but Call of Cthulhu is like, you know, the literary canon, like the one of the all-time accepted greats of role-playing. And at long last, we've made it to the end. Number one, can you guess what the greatest occult role-playing game of all time is? And by the way, it's by a long shot. It's heads and shoulders above the other ones, at least in how it represents magic. Can you guess? I'll give you a few seconds. It is Mage the Ascension. Okay, this is it. Look how thick this book is. This is not just the most profound role-playing game I've ever played. It's also, these books for this role-playing game are some of the most profound occult books I've ever read. First, there was Vampire the Masquerade, which was a gigantic financial success and allowed the company to try to repeat that model with other supernatural beings. They did Werewolf the Apocalypse. But the third one was Mage the Ascension. And this game, I think it was invented by one of the people running the company after he read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. But basically what this game is about the collision of reality tunnels. And I can't think of a more profound metaphor for our current world. In Mage, by the way, Mage, other than the original initial book, Mage for its entire lifespan was developed and is now currently being developed because it's backed by Phil Brucato, who is a real life neo-pagan and chaos magician and takes this game very seriously as a form of chaos magic. I've also had him on my show a long time ago, if you scroll back. So actual magic went into this. And I mean, you know, I've heard him say on a podcast, you know, these games basically, by the time the Dungeons and Dragons kids got to college, some, you know, the people who invented this game were going advanced. And that meant they were basically sitting around their dorm rooms, tripping balls, playing role-playing games and seeing, kind of combining it with experimental theater and seeing how far out they could get. So Mage, I'm not going to lie, this is the game that got me into the occult for real. And that the reason is, not because of any thematic or, you know, satanic element or something like that. The reason was it's because it proposed a very interesting model of the world that actually made sense to me. So in Mage, you're a person in the modern world, in the real world, that has awakened. That means, much like in real magic, that you've essentially become awake, aware, that you're aware magic exists, that it has potential, that you can't, and that you're beginning to realize that you actually do have the power to shape reality. Okay, great. Now, all the other role-playing games feature the occult either as just like an effect somebody can do, like a magic power, we're not going to talk about that one game. Outside of that, okay. Anyways, of the top four role-playing games, the one they basically depict magic more or less as something that a character can learn, or some of them, like Call of Cthulhu, do depict magic as a malevolent force that the bad guys have. Mage, however, is totally different. What Mage is about is not just being a magician who's awakened and can shape reality, but What is it like when you then have to deal with everyone else who is trying to shape reality? And there's tons of factions in this game. There's kind of the ones that represent fundamentalist Christians. They're the ones that represent kind of like shamanic, neo-shamanic people. There's the ones that represent Wiccans. But there's also the ones that represent like the forces of what they call the technocracies. So, you know, the forces of control, the gray faces, as William Burroughs put it, the forces that want to lock down society, lock down magic, and make sure that people don't remember who they are. Profound. When the game first came out, it was pretty much this dichotomy of you know, magical people versus technological scientific people. I think that theme has aged fairly poorly, but the game changed a lot as it went on, to the point where you can essentially play an awakened person from any reality tunnel. And the thing about this game is, like, one is not better than the other. All it represents a world in which you have essentially lots of secret societies, awakened people running around trying to shape the world in their image, but they're all fighting with all the other ones that are trying to do that. So and they call this in the game the Ascension War or the Reality War. Each of these groups has their vision for the ultimate outcome of humanity. For instance, the traditions, so like the neo-pagans and all of them, the people like us, all of that. They want a world in which everyone is liberated, in which everyone is awakened, in which the forces of control, you know, all this, we've heard this stuff in real life, in which all the forces of domination and control are gone. But then we have the technocracy, who have a different vision for reality, which is not evil. It's just that they want everything to be clean, ordered. They want scientific progress. They want reality. They want reality deviants locked down. So basically what this game is about is gangs of mostly well-intentioned magicians duking it out for reality. And essentially the point the game makes is they're all a-holes. This is true in real life too. It's like, you know, all these, essentially this is a game about people who are trying to push their reality and their narrative on other people. So in this game, unlike in Dungeons and Dragons, you're fighting with swords and maces and all of that. In Mage of the Ascension, you're fighting with belief systems, philosophies, and views of the world. And so this game, playing this game, is phenomenally useful in assessing the modern world, just like, you know, Robert Anton Wilson's idea of reality tunnels is. These are ideas that people should look at again. We now live in the world of fake news. We live in a world where magic is back. We live in a world where there's not a whole lot of rationality sometimes. We live in a world in which something's true as long as it's on social media, and propaganda and media distortion and all of this. So while this game came out in the early 90s, it's very predictive of the world that we're in now and has a lot to say to us. And just so you don't get confused, there was kind of a reboot of this game released in the 2000s called Mage the Awakening. It's not connected to the other game. This one tried to make magic all about the real occult. And so I want to give this kind of an honorary mention. You know, this is about the real occult. You know, there's Enochian watchtowers and all of that in here in Golden Dawn, but I haven't played it. And it's not as interesting to me as Mage the Ascension, just because the idea of people going around doing spells at each other is way less interesting to me than people fighting with reality and belief systems. And if you look at the world right now, that's basically it. I mean, you can look at people, you know, particularly influencers. We have all these people running around, Jordan Peterson or, you know, other people, like everyone, every influencer kind of wants to shape the world in their own image. So reality is a war of narratives. Mage predicted this, and it's a profound way of looking at the world. So if you take away anything, I hope it's just my deep enthusiasm for role-playing itself and my really conviction that it offers a lot of the stuff that our society needs, and that it's a profoundly healthy thing for, yes, grown adults to do on a regular basis. Hey, it beats going out to the bar and wasting your money on drinking, okay? By a long mile. All right, lots of love. I will see you soon. All right. I hope you really, really enjoyed that. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get it. And definitely, definitely, definitely head over to YouTube. Make sure you are subscribed to the YouTube. Like and subscribe. It's at Magic Me School, or just search Magic Me, M-A-G-I-C-K-M-E, on YouTube. Like and subscribe. Hit the notifications bell. We're releasing on Fridays. Leave a comment. Lots of love, and I will see you, of course, as always, in class.